Good evening. We have a new face tonight, all the way from Colorado. This is Judith. Very pleased to. We haven't seen each other for a long time, so this is very special. Let's do intros again.
I'm Don.
Judith.
Jeffrey.
Ellen.
Paul.
Marie.
Ron.
Samuel.
Bob.
Cassandra.
Donovan.
Wendy.
Me too.
So we talked about a lot of things, but we didn't talk about what we're doing here, which is this amazing document called the Lankavatara Sutra. It's a very old one and a very interesting one. It's at the very beginning of Zen, the transition from the Theravadan tradition to the Yogacara, actually, as a school. And it's different. It's the same, but it's different as this thing constantly is morphing from one version of itself to another. So it doesn't change essentially, but culturally, certainly, and even in the depth of understanding and the direction of attention that is called on. Each sutra has a different, definitely different attitude and direction, calling us to look in a certain way, sort of saying it's over here, which is a trick, of course, because it isn't exactly over here at all. But in order to talk about it, we have to project. And this book, although it's talking about projections as being the one thing we need to drop, is a big projection all by itself. It is itself a projection for us. So it's pointing out how complex our mind is about our experience of life, of things. And basically it's about our proclivity for separating everything out and feeling that there's nothing but stuff and it's all separate. And that if we fail to see the connections and fail to see that everything basically is connected and that that things are provisional, temporary, everything that we project as something is a very tenuous thing. It's there, but it's not there. It's there for such a short time that it's coming and going. You can't say it is, and you can't say it isn't. And our wish to call it is, is one form of attachment. Our wish to call it not there is another kind of attachment. And so as bodhisattva practice, we practice in the middle. We can't say. And if we do say, we're caught in a web of projections, of thinking, trying to figure it all out. So it's not figure outable in that way, in the thought, the thinking way. Best we can say is that it's all of a piece. And yet we live as this separate appearing being, short term. So I think we've gotten to page 151. So at the top of the page, which is still number 50, this is all kind of linked together from 50 for the next few chapters, which ends this section. It's about two kinds of knowing, the kind of knowing that examines and the knowing that's based on characteristics, attachment to characteristics of projection. So the knowing that examines is actually stopping and authentically encountering what is before one. It's not tacking a label onto whatever is there and saying flower. It's openness and intimacy and curiosity in which we can meet, encounter what we call flower. What we experience is that particular flare of color that we very awkwardly call flower. It is ever so much more than that. But if we cling to it, to its characteristics, and become attached to the word for it, for instance, and think the word actually is the thing, we're lost. There are many ways to get bewildered around the way that we don't understand that all those things are projections, and that what we see as flower is a projection. So Buddha is saying that the knowing based on attachment of the characteristics is one of the ways of knowing, and the other way is the examination. The knowing that examines focuses on the characteristics of self-existence of whatever exists, and concludes that they are beyond the reach of the four possibilities and not graspable. It can't be held and owned and known in the way of grasping. This is what is meant by the knowing that examines. So then, there are four possibilities. Everything exists is beyond the reach of the four possibilities, and you should practice examining everything, Mahamati, according to them. So this is just like Dogen saying, study the self. Really examine your mind and how it is that you meet what you meet. How it is that we know what we know, or think we know what we know. So the attachment to characteristics of projection refers to erroneous projections of solidity, moisture, warmth, and movement, the four elements, and to proposition, reason, characteristics, and example as the foundation on which such falsehoods are based. This is the knowing that's based on attachment to characteristics of projection. Characterizes two kinds of knowing is what these are. Bodhisattvas, by mastering what these characterizes two kinds of knowing, bodhisattvas finally understand the absence of a self among persons and things, and understand the means by which to use their projectionist knowledge to examine the stages of practice. As they reach the initial stage, they enter hundreds of samadhis. And some of these, they see hundreds of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Kalpas in the past and future. They go to higher stages, and by their peerless vows and their masteries and higher powers, they reach the personal realization of the Tathagata stage. With their mind well focused on the 10 inexhaustible vows, they bring others to perfection and manifest themselves in a variety of refulgent forms while enjoying the bliss of samadhi and the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. So what does this mean for us? It means that when we were born, we already were born with these two kinds of knowledge. And that to this very day, all of us are trying to understand, what is this? Why is this? How can I be with this? What is it? What is moisture? What is fire? What is a newborn baby? What is it to be very, very old? All of these things are projections. As long as we assume that there is a basic self nature in each aspect that we characterize, we give a characterization to the various ways that things smell, the way they look, the way they function, and that's our projection of that thing as being a thing with characteristics. And until we see that the way we use our mind in attachment to things and attachment to the characteristics of things, that we're stuck. So I thought I would ask what this means to you for your life. How often do we get stuck attached and owning something that is not real, is just a projection from our own mind? Something that we think without noticing that it's this totally tenuous piece of a vast matrix of dynamic life, which sometimes is called love. So as someone said, it's not too meaningful unless we think of how it is with our life, how often we go astray. Like I characterize my cat, for instance, as my cat. She's mine. Somebody gave her to me, and so I actually adopted her into my affections and began to see her in a particular way that I wouldn't see if she belonged to one of you. She would be somebody else's cat, and she would have a totally different nature in my mind. So you see already how tenuous our projections are. Our notions about things are all based on nothing, actually. And so now that I own Sophie, this is a really ridiculous attitude to take, because it's not true. We don't own anything. There's no way to own anything. We have responsibilities for various things. Taking care of ourselves, number one. Taking care of our car and our house and our spouse and our kids and all the things that come through our life. But we don't own anything. We're more likely to be owned by than to be owned. Donalyn?
On a very, I think it's a superficial level that it, for me, it you know, manifests outwards. He's so surprised that my husband says I don't listen well when I finish his sentences. Because I think I know him and I'm intuitive, you know, dominant intuitive, and I've lived with him over 30 years. You know, I still think I probably got a 50% chance of being right. But it's so totally, you know, this projection of what our relationship is and what I know him as. And it's just, it's, of course, it's habitual. And yet paying attention even on this, in this, you know, the most mundane posture or something, it easily can be transformed into hearing a story that even after 30-some years, I've never heard before. Really being open to something, understanding that his right is my left, and you know, all of these things, and it can extend. I can see how that all extends out, mm-hmm. and the projection that I have on somebody else, it limits them too. In my mind, and maybe in their behavior, actions. So, at that level, it's happening.
Yeah,
almost all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm hanging on to the attachment that my dog is special.
Your dog, my cat.
I don't know what your cat is like, but all you have to do is watch my cat, and my cat knows that this is a projection, or doesn't care whether it is or isn't.
Yeah.
One thing I do enjoy about the cat is observing.
Yeah.
The cat is very much totally, well, I don't know, this is a projection. But seems to be really, really in the moment. When she wakes up, she wants to not wake her in a room, so she doesn't do anything untoward. Mm-hmm. But then she comes out, she looks at her. When she's fed, okay, I'm finished with you. And proceeds about her. You know, if she feels like showing some affection once in a while, she will. Cats seem to have a, you know, a little kind of centeredness, and they are really, in the moment. They don't cater to the whims of humans that much.
No, not at all. They're very independent.
I think there's a lot to learn by observing different animals like that.
Well, there are teachers. Yes. Yes. Right. Right. But if we become completely enmeshed with their lives in the way that some people do with each other or with their animals, then it's clearly not the reality of the way things are. It's our way of intimacy, you could say, with what comes through our life. But at the same time, it's not real. It's a gift, but it's an ephemeral gift, and can be devastating if we become so attached that we lose, which we invariably do. Lose the person that we become so fond of. It's one of the ways that humans suffer. because we're positing a self that isn't really there, either here or there. So that's part of what this teaching is about. You know, it's that if we get caught up in that selfness too deeply, then we are in a kind of dream world. So we're more easily hurt. We're more easily confounded by what happens because we're not willing to remember that we ourselves are just a little tiny shred of a piece of this, what everything is a tiny shred of a piece of, this nameless life of us. So he goes on to say that the bodhisattva should know that in reality the four elements don't arise, the earth, air, fire, and water, that they're just names for a non-arising of what we are naming as something. If they examine the non-arising of the four elements, once they've done so, they will know that the distinguishing of names, appearances, and projections is the distinguishing of perceptions of their own mind, and that their eternal existence does not exist. This is what is meant by distinguishing projections as perceptions of the mind. This is what is meant by distinguishing projections as perceptions of the mind. This means to see that the three realms are devoid of the existence of the four elements and their elemental forms, meaning all the stuff, including us, that they are completely devoid of the four possibilities, and that they include no self or anything that belongs to a self, and to focus instead on the essential characteristics of reality, the essential characteristic of which consists in non-arising. So I don't remember what the four possibilities are, but let's see if he tells us. Lots of force. The sequence used by logicians to represent all possible outcomes of any event. It's either X or it's Y, or it's both X and Y, or neither X or Y. And non-arising is, in his words, well, he doesn't analyze it, because it's when we characterize something, if we don't characterize something, then we're creating a non-arising, the essential characteristics of reality. In other words, it's happening in us, or we are as we project a self on everything, losing the sense of reality, which is that there is no self in that way. So he goes on to say the four elements give rise to elemental forms, because they're distinguished as moisture, producing internal and external realms of water. The element, as distinguished as energy, produces internal and external realms of fire. The element distinguished as movement produces internal and external realms of wind. And the element distinguished as divisible form produces internal and external realms of earth. And with form comes space. According to those who cling to mistaken truths, it is the four elements and their elemental forms that give rise to the assemblage of the five skandhas. He goes on to say, consciousness continues in another existence because of the delight for different realms. As for earth and the other elements and their elemental forms, Mahamati, the four elements serve as its conditions, and the four elements do not serve as its conditions. The elements do not arise unless nature, shape, location, and function exist. But even if they do arise together with nature, shape, location, and function, they do not do so with regard to what is formless. He says, even if the four elements could be linked to the skanda of form, they cannot be linked to the four formless skandhas of sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. Even if they do arise together with nature, shape, location, and function, Mahamati, they do not do so with regard to what is formless. Therefore, the four elements and their elemental forms are projections of other paths, not mine. So it's how things come into being. So does it come as a lightning stroke and out of that, somehow out of earth and fire and wind and water, a body is formed. And those are the five skandhas of form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness. It's always talking of the body and the consciousness, the body and the mind. And the mind, that the body is a projection of knowledge of the body, which is not complete or accurate or even true. And in the sense of that, we can't even see our body as it exists in space. We will never see our body. We look in the mirror and try to look around to see what's going on behind. but that's a reflection. We don't see ourselves. We just see little pieces, bits and pieces. So we project a self on this illusion of a body that we characterize with what we feel as we name all the bits and pieces of us. And we put it together in a kind of story, really. The story of the human body. Which is so, has such a brilliant mind that it creates brilliant worlds, brilliant thought worlds and idea worlds. That are quite different from the reality of things. He says, Mahamati, by form, I am referring to the different characteristics of each of the four elements in their elemental forms. But Mahamati, the formless ones, are actually four in number. They're like the sky. They're not actually four. They're like the sky, just as the sky is void of numbers or the characteristics of numbers. It's only due to our projection that we speak of one sky. And so the skandhas are the same. We speak of them as having characteristics of numbers. But really, it's devoid of existence or non-existence. Foolish beings talk in terms of numbers, not the wise. So it's 8 o'clock. I'm sorry, it went a little bit longer than I thought it would. So that's halfway through 52 on page 153. And I will be here next week. I've decided to do Sesshin in a unique way, sort of like my teacher did, only much more consciously, I think, that I will come in the afternoon and be available for Doksan after the work period and give the Dharma talk and then be home the rest of the time. So I want to see if that will work more easily for me. I have gotten to two very strict finger shakings saying you must take better care of yourself. So this is how I'm trying to do that. And we'll see how it works, and if halfway through the week it's not working, then I'll do something else. I'll be available and I'll be ready to change my mind at any moment. But I want to try this and see if this will work so that I can still be there, because I would feel very badly not to be there. But a whole session has gotten to be too much. Much as I love it. Yeah. So I'll come on Tuesday evening and whoever's not going to Sesshin will come on Tuesday evening. And then that's a couple of weeks from now, isn't it? Yes. And that's the end of practice period. The end of Sesshin is the end of practice period. And I hope you all know about it and have a plan for yourself and are finding extra things to do to deepen your practice, widen your practice, create more time for your practice. It's a wonderful opportunity to give us more focus on this part of our life.